recounts the future of local newspapers, and a virtual rock documentary. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There were a few recounts in Broward and Miami-Dade counties from the November general election that concluded this weekend. One of the races may be stained by dark money. We'll get the latest update. Also,
the Miami Times was the subject of the day, always. There were usually three generations sitting at a table. None of us agreed.
Garth Reeves was groomed from a very early age to take over the family business. His great-grandfather founded the Miami Times. Today, he runs the paper, and he shared the challenges of keeping the business sustainable. Finally, the Frost Music School decides to put the cameras on their teachers and students to show the outside world how young musicians are creating during a pandemic. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, Florida's elections went very smoothly for state standards. There weren't any major issues with counting mail-in ballots and early voting throughout the state. But there were several local races in Broward and Miami-Dade that came to razor-thin margins, and it required recounts. Well, the state Senate race in Miami-Dade for District 37 is the focus of a lot of scrutiny. We're going to look at these recounts. I want to bring in WLRN reporters Danny Rivero and Katie Switalski-Munoz. Danny, Katie, thank you so much.
Thanks, Liz.
Danny, I want to start with you. In Miami-Dade, there is one race, but this is a fascinating story. It's got a little bit of a twist. It's the state Senate race between Democrat Jose Javier Rodriguez, he was the incumbent, and Republican Ileana Garcia. Let's paint the picture here. I mean, this was a very tight race, came down to 34 votes.
That's right. This was a razor-thin race. This was a seat that Democrats were hoping to be able to keep as they were trying to gain some other seats in other parts of the state. And, you know, statewide, it ended up being the closest state Senate race. On the one side, you have a political newcomer, Ileana Garcia. She's, like I said, a political newcomer, but she did co-found the Latinas for Trump group in 2016. She's a Cuban American, Miami native. She's given very few interviews during the campaign process. So she hasn't spoken a whole lot to the media. We've reached out to her in our campaign. We haven't heard back. And then on the other side, you have the Senator Jose Javier Rodriguez, who is a state senator, a Democrat, who is trying to defend the seat that he was holding. And he's kind of known for wearing rain boots in Tallahassee as a way to bring awareness to climate change. That's been a big thing that he's been championing. And he was hoping to hold on to the seat and do more work on that. It didn't quite work out. Like you just mentioned, it came down to only 34 votes.
And so, of course, now controversy has popped up because there was a third candidate on the ballot. What do we know about this person? Who was it?
Right. So it's a really interesting, really fishy or shady, you might be able to say. The third candidate, his name was Alex Rodriguez. And it's something that I looked into, too. We didn't even know what this Alex Rodriguez character looked like. It's someone that did no campaigning, no fundraising. Like I said, we didn't even have a picture of this person. And with all those things as they are, you know, he ran as an independent, non-party affiliated candidate and got 6,300 votes. So the margin of victory in this race was 34 votes. This person, Alex Rodriguez, got about 6,300. And an investigation just last week by Local 10's Glenna Milberg, you know, all the credit to her. She really peeled back some layers on this and uncovered some mysterious things going on. But basically, she was able to find that this candidate filed to run on the same day as a couple other third party candidates in other state races. They were funded by a mysterious PAC called Our Florida that nobody knows where they get their money from. And Alex Rodriguez, who is running, was also recently registered as a Republican. So there is some pretty strong suggestions that there was some behind the scenes things going on to try to take some votes away from a Democratic candidate in this race.
All right. So let me start with this. Do we know who this Alex Rodriguez is? Has anybody ever talked to him?
Well, like I said, Local 10's Glenna Milberg did do a story on this, and she actually went to one of the listed addresses that's affiliated with him. And she did speak to him, but when she spoke to him, he lied about his identity and said that he was just a friend of Alex Rodriguez. But then we later learned, no, that was actually him, and he lied about who he was.
All right, and he got 6,400 votes. I mean, have we ever figured out how does a person who does no campaigning whatsoever, you've never heard of him, get 6,400 votes?
Right. So that's where some of the potential shadiness comes in, because no campaigning, but there were flyers sent out to many people within the district that listed typically Democratic positions. And that was the only campaigning of any kind that this character did. And the allegation, and this is something that Senator Rodriguez brought up before the Local 10 investigation too. He said, look, there's something that's not right about this. This is a candidate that has his same last name, sending some flyers out, running on similar positions, and just making the allegation that there's something nefarious going on. Maybe the Republican Party, maybe some other non-party. The Republican Party says they had nothing to do with this, but just making the allegation that something shady is behind all this.
So, I mean, were any rules broken?
Not in some ways. What they did is not illegal. It's definitely ethically questionable, but not illegal. There is an open question about whether the flyers that went out did violate some kind of campaign laws, because they were not posted in the way that they should be posted in the state records keeping. So there could be some kind of violation there. The Senator Rodriguez has called for an investigation, and the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office says it's aware of that call for an investigation, but they can't say one way or the other if they're looking into it or if they're not.
Mm. Something right out of a novel. You know, I'm just curious for you, Danny, what was unique for you covering Miami-Dade elections this year compared to past years?
You know, there was a lot of activism. There was a lot of activism on both sides. I mean, especially on the Republican side, there was a ton of energy. I mean, you had these huge caravans, people supporting President Trump, and you know, as kind of expected, a lot of that momentum behind President Trump and his gains here in South Florida really helped sweep in a lot of Republicans in this race. And Ileana Garcia, who just won the seat for State Senate District 37, she really rode on those coattails. I mean, like I said, she has done very little media, little few interviews. She didn't show up to a debate. And having that R next to her name really helped get her past the finish line on this, 34 vote difference.
34 votes, and you have a third candidate nobody knows much about who gets 6,400 votes, and sounds like a Netflix special. Danny Rivero, always a pleasure. It could be. Danny, thanks so much.
Thanks, Louis.
All right. I'm going to turn over now to, again, we're talking about some of the recounts from this weekend, because there were a few. That was the only one in Miami-Dade. There were a few races that were recounted in Broward County. Let me turn now to our Broward County reporter, Katie Switalski-Munoz. All right, Katie, I don't know if you have a story that's as juicy as that one, but let's take a look at what did happen. We had some recounts on local races. There was one for judge.
Yes, there was. And it's funny you mentioned that, Louis. We don't have anything that rivals the plot of what happened in Miami-Dade County, but we had more recounts. So we had four races, local races, that needed to be recounted. And the biggest one was this countywide judicial race. And it was between an incumbent judge, Dennis Bailey, and an attorney who co-founded and is a partner at a law office in Fort Lauderdale, George Odom Jr. And it's pretty rare for, at least in a judicial race, for an incumbent sitting judge to lose his seat. And that's what happened here, actually, after the recount. So it's not unheard of, but certainly it's not common that a sitting judge loses his seat.
And it was, again, these are razor-thin margins. I hate to say that word over and over, but it is. It's true. It was very close.
It was, and it was a race that, so in Florida, you have to go to a machine recount if the margin is under 0.5, underneath 0.5%. And if it's still really close after that and it falls under this margin of under a quarter of a percent, then it goes to manual recounts. And so what we saw on Friday in Broward County was you had overvotes and undervotes for this race getting recounted. And if you add that together, it was almost 177,000 ballots that had to be reviewed and recounted by hand. And so that was what was taking place inside the elections warehouse in Lauder Hill. And looking at the overvotes and the undervotes, so they weren't looking at every single ballot in this race. They're looking at the ballots that when the machine reads them, they're considered undervotes because the machine reads them as blank. So a human has to review those just to see if there's any other mark on the ballot. And then the overvotes, and that happens when people make strange markings or appear to vote for more than one candidate in a race. So it could be like if someone underlines their candidate and made a mark, or if they circle the candidate. You saw a lot of check marks where people made a big check mark for their candidate, but the line of their check mark went into the other candidate's bubble. So those kind of things people were looking at one by one on Friday. And it's funny, you know, hand recounts don't really normally change the outcome of races. You can pick up a few votes, but I mean, the margin between these candidates was 0.16.
Yeah.
And that actually was about 1,200 votes, and it really didn't change that much.
So there was a city commission race in Hallandale Beach. This one really close, 9 votes. Tell me what happened in this one. What's going on?
Yeah, so before the recount, the two candidates were separated by 10 votes. After the recount, they were separated by 9. And so you had candidate Annabelle Lima-Taub beating Cynthia Cabrera for this Hallandale Beach seat. And that's really, really, really close. We didn't see something quite that close with the Dania Beach race. There was a city commission race in Dania Beach that also had to be recounted. That was only a machine recount. But it's interesting. I will tell you, Dania Beach does this thing on the ballot where they have a list of candidates and then the voter is supposed to pick 3. And so that's why we had this recount in Dania Beach in between the 3rd and 4th place candidate, because it's not something you normally see on a ballot.
And then one other thing too, in Davie, there was a question on the ballot about a town charter that did get flipped. This again, also close.
Yes. And so the question was, Davie had a bunch of questions on the ballot this year. I think they had 11 about language and updating their charter and what language should be left in the town's charter, which is like their signature town governing document. And so they have to ask voters every time they want to change the language in that document. And so this was a strange question because it really, you know, at first glance may not seem that impactful, but the question was asking voters if they wanted to remove language from this charter that talked about selling property. And so it was incredibly close. And actually before the recount, it had more no votes than yes votes. And then after the recount, it had more yes votes, just, I think, 13 yes votes. And so these races are close, and it does show you that sometimes the recount really, really makes a difference. But when I was talking to Broward County's new judge, George Odom Jr., who won the judicial race, he mentioned, you know, he felt like he had this experience firsthand of every single vote count. It could come down to just a couple of votes. And he felt like he had seen that firsthand this time.
It literally can come down to just a couple of votes. like the number of people in front of you at a store. Exactly. You know what? It's interesting. We always keep saying in Florida, we had a good election in the sense that it went without much controversy. All the controversy nationally isn't on other states. But what have you heard from elections officials in Broward County about how this election went down? And is there anything they need to work on as we move forward before we go to another election?
So in Broward County, we have Peter Antonacci as our current supervisor of elections. He was really brought in to fix things after our last supervisor was removed from office. And so he had a really big task ahead of him because our 2018 midterm elections did not go smoothly. And this time they really did. I think he felt really proud that, you know, this was able to sort of get Broward County's election office back on track in terms of being reliable, following the election laws, running smoothly. Everybody knows where everything is supposed to go. And so he was just really, really happy that it was able to happen under him, and it was able to go so well here. Broward County has a new supervisor of elections that was just elected in this general election. His name is Joe Scott, a Democrat. And so, you know, I saw him at these recounts learning and watching and, you know, following how to handle such close races. And it's pretty remarkable to see this transition of power happen when other states did not have elections as smoothly as Florida did. And I will just add, like, I think it's really important to point out for anybody questioning the process, because we have seen quite a bit of that, this process would be happening in Broward County, you know, in any normal year after any election.
Right.
Some races are really close, and this kind of process is very normal to take this long after a general election.
Yeah, always a reminder that, yes, races can be close. There could be recounts. That does not mean there's a problem with the system, and it is just part of the process. Recounts do take time. I do believe that we heard on nationally that this, according to the Homeland Security offices, the most secure election we've ever had. Katie Switalski, appreciate the time as always.
Thanks, Lewis.
Again, that is Katie Switalski-Munoz, our Broward County reporter. I want to thank Danny Rivero covering Miami-Dade County. Those are the elections officials numbers that came out finally in the recounts over the weekend. You can always find out more, learn more on our website, WLRN.org. Well, still to come, Garth Reeves was born into the newspaper industry. We're going to learn how his family has led the Miami Times through depressions, recessions, and everything else. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, one of the country's largest black newspapers was founded in Miami by a Bahamian immigrant back in 1923. The Miami Times weekly paper was initially printed one page at a time on a small hand press from Henry E.S. Reeves' modest Miami home. It survived decades, writing one of the first drafts of South Florida history through protests, social change, economic downturns, elections, you name it. It's seen everything. The paper has been passed down through the family, and today it's run by his great-grandson, Garth Reeves. Earlier this year, he purchased the Biscayne Times and signed off on renovating the Miami Times building. All of this at a time when most newspapers are cutting corners. We spoke with him last week about his plans to continue to build his family's legacy.
I really grew up in the Miami Times. As far back as I can remember, I grew up in the office. If I wanted to see my mother, the best chance was going to be if I was in the Miami Times. She was working long, long hours, late into the night, so I found myself after school going to the office. And I'd do my homework there, and once I finished up with that, I kind of started, you know, poking around and seeing what everyone else was up to, not minding my own business, and sometimes even getting in a little bit of trouble. But that's kind of how I got into the business from a young age.
You know, I mean, you think back to that. I mean, you're a young man, but when you were a kid, the business was so different. Remind us of like what the newspaper business was like back then.
Oh, wow. I mean, a lot of the long hours I remember was because, you know, technology is not what it is today. So it was so much more labor intensive putting together a newspaper. And, you know, I grew up well into the, you know, the era of computers. They were not cutting and pasting anymore, but technology is not what it was. I remember every Tuesday after deadline, we would have to copy all of the files to a zip drive, and then someone would have to drive them to the printer, and the printer would then get the files and, you know, begin printing. And that had to take place every single Tuesday night. It's really something.
Tell me a little bit about, because it was your great-grandfather, right? Henry Sigmund Reeves, who started the paper.
Yes, yes, yes. He started it originally as a commercial printing business and then transitioned into the newspaper.
Growing up, what did you learn about him?
That he was truly a businessman. He was committed to every aspect of the Miami Times. He opened up the shop every single day. You know, right up to his death, he was trying to stay involved with the operation of the paper, which is something that seems to be true of all Reeves's. We can't seem to, you know, detach ourselves, even in retirement, from the Miami Times.
What were the principles of the paper when it was founded?
I mean, you know, a strong commitment to local journalism, being the voice of our community, telling our story and, you know, getting it right. Our core principles are, you know, really do remain the same, whereas a lot of other factors have changed over time. How we deliver news to our readers has changed, but, you know, our commitment remains the same. We still put a lot of effort into producing a paper each week.
And when you say community, is that we're just talking about Miami, or are you focused on specific community?
I mean, when I say Miami, we go in, the Miami Times goes from Fort Lauderdale, we're in parts of Broward, all the way down to Florida City, as far as distribution. So it's, you know, the Black community, we're spread throughout. So, you know, we find ourselves having to cover a lot of different neighborhoods, you know, throughout South Florida.
Tell me a little bit about how your mom ran the paper, what it was like under her.
My mother was, in the true sense, a businesswoman. She was a shrewd businesswoman. I think a lot of our success and how we've been able to sustain through, you know, the downturn, you know, the crash, I think has been because of the way she's run that business and the way I've learned to run the Miami Times.
I'm wondering, like, if, you know, as you were growing up, I mean, was the talk at the dinner table a lot of business? Was she trying to just constantly teach you?
I don't think it was intentionally meant to be a lesson, but yes, that's all we talked about. The Miami Times was the subject of the day, always. It followed us home. And then you have to realize, at, you know, there were usually three generations sitting at a table, you know, my grandfather, my mother, myself. We all had different perspectives on how we think something should have been done. None of us agreed. So it was a real mess sometimes, but we always seemed to find a way through. You know, I had my grandfather, you know, well into his 90s, giving his perspective, you know, not necessarily always realizing how business has changed. You know, here's a perfect example. He didn't realize that the cost of business had become what it was, and he thought that we were overcharging. He's like, "Your rates are too high." I'm like, "They're in line with the market." He, you know, he just didn't realize how things had progressed, how, you know, the cost of doing business. So that was, you know, that was a tug of war. I finally got permission to increase the price of the paper from 50 cents to I went up to 93 cents about 3 years ago. And I had been waging that war for about 4 or 5 years prior to that, because we were losing money on every copy we sold. And finally, they said, okay, you can increase the price of the paper.
So for you, I mean, there was no question. You knew you were going to be in the business. I mean, I don't know if at any point in your youth, did you have other aspirations?
I wasn't exactly brought up to think that there were other options, which was very strategic, probably, you know, on their end, my grandfather and my mother. You know, it was just always assumed that I was going to be the newspaper publisher. And growing up in the business, I learned to love it. It's a great industry to be in. I like what I do. It's definitely a challenge, you know, day in and day out. But I don't long to do anything else.
So when you finally, you know, when you finished school and you came back, I mean, you took over the paper. You were really young.
Yes, but it was kind of a. I didn't fully take over right out of college, though. Upon graduating, I got back home, and almost immediately, my mother got diagnosed with cancer. So that kind of pushed me, you know, into the role. But you know, she's always been right there with me. You know, oftentimes, on the phone, I'm on the phone with one staff member, she's on the phone with another, probably telling the other person, it's like, ignore everything he's saying, do what I tell you to do. Which was always very fun. But yeah, I was pretty young, but I was pretty prepared, I like to think. It was pretty seamless coming right out. You know, I spent my summers during college, you know, right in the paper. So when I graduated and got back, it was just, you know, an easy transition.
You guys are renovating your office. I was thinking about how the Herald left their office And, you know, I mean, because of COVID now, they said eventually they'll get into an office, but, you know, that's an interesting story. They've been moving around and I mean, this is just the business. The industry has been changing so much and newspapers have been shrinking, but you seem to be growing. And you talk about your latest acquisition, you know, the Biscayne Times, right? So how is it that you're growing, expanding, and the industry is shrinking?
Because I believe that there's still a need for local journalism. And the community, I think the community is starting to recognize that, I hope. The work that we do is very important. We make a difference every week, you know, with the Miami Times. And the Biscayne Times also makes a difference. And I believe with that acquisition, I'm just further realizing, you know, my family's mission and, you know, remaining, you know, steadfast to tell the stories of the community, be the voice of our readers, you know, get the news out to the people. And I think we do a pretty good job.
Tell me about how, you know, I want to understand how Black-owned newspaper geared toward the Black reader is different from other local newspapers.
You know, our focus is on our community. We focus on the issues, ideas, you know, themes that matter most and impact them the greatest. We're their voice oftentimes to get their feelings, their perspectives out to the rest of the world. That's the biggest difference. We are very focused. We stay in our lane, and that allows us to do, you know, the best work. You know, when you have to, you know, be everything to everybody, it takes a toll on, you know, the finished product. So we're able to hone in and focus on our community, the current issues that are impacting them, and that's where we go, you know, every week.
And it's so interesting you talk about that, and this may be a very unique community compared to others, is that when you say, you know, you're trying to reach the Black reader, that, I mean, you're talking about African Americans, Haitians, Bahamians, so yeah. Such a diverse group. How do you keep that, you know, explore that nuance in that diversity and still, you know, because it's a lot.
It is. And, you know, one thing that I always like to say, you will not find the term African-American in the Miami Times anywhere, unless it's used in a quote that someone else said it, because we try to unify under Black. We're stronger together as a group. You know, we can be more effective. We can further our cause if we work together. And our Blackness is a unifier in that regard. So that's why we always use Black instead of African American. But you're right, it's a lot. You know, we would love to do more. There's a lot of communities, you know, Haitians, Bahamians, Afro-Cuban, you know, there's a lot out there, but we try to at least get to the big issues. And, you know, respond when we see a need.
You know, talking about, when I asked you earlier about like big stories, well, obviously this year, we have the pandemic. The other one, of course, is the election. And I'm wondering, you know, how you covered it differently than, say, the Miami Herald. What was the strategy?
What are the issues that impact our community? What's important to them? What matters to them? We're looking at violence, economic development, jobs, equality. You know, these are issues that on a local level and a national level are important, and we try to hone in on them when we plan our coverage for all politics. A lot of people have been asking me, they think it's strange, like, well, how are you going to handle that with Biscayne Times? Are you going to change the focus of Biscayne Times, to be more like Miami Times? And that is not the case at all. We're going to continue, we're going to take that mission that we have of community journalism, delivering what's important to our audience, and bring them the news that's relevant to them. And we do the exact same thing for Biscayne Times.
Again, we don't know what's going to happen to the local papers, but you know, we know that there's such an important need for local journalism that's so vital. But what do you, you know, I'm wondering, like, you know, and what your mom and your grandfather taught you about the future, like what those goals are. You are expanding. You obviously had, you know, getting the Biscayne Times, you're renovating your offices. But what are the goals moving forward to the future? And what do you see as the future for papers like yours and local journalism?
That's tricky. I think it's changing every single, it's changing every single day. I feel like our industry doesn't exactly know what the future holds. We're throwing a lot of things against the wall and seeing what sticks. I think it's important that we're agile and we're responsive to the needs of our readers. And as long as we are able to deliver, we should, you know, continue to be relevant and necessary to the communities that we serve.
Garth, let me ask you this. One of the tricky parts with local news is, again, cost and keeping operations going. And so you'll see some newspapers start to outsource, outside local because it's cheaper. But how do you do it? How do you stay local and keep using that local talent that knows the local story? How do you do that?
You're very right. It is a challenge. And, in the last 5 years, I've seen a big increase in, even among Black newspapers, all outlets outsourcing anything from, reporting to page design, all facets. I know one newspaper publisher told me she has a virtual office. And I was like, I don't know how you run a newspaper with a virtual office. For our readers, for our publications, Miami Times, Biscayne Times, to be able to deliver for our audiences, we need those individuals that are here locally that know the community, that know the likes, preferences, know the people, know the right people to contact to get things done, that are in touch. And it's essential. And it's difficult, but you have to watch your budgets, but you have to spend the money, you have to invest. Both of our publications are produced locally. We don't outsource any facet of it. Have we explored it? Yes. But we've determined that it just doesn't really work, or won't really work for us the way we deliver the news. That's why it's so important that, advertising matters, because that's what allows us to continue to produce quality publications, produce quality news using local talent from our community.
That was Garth Reeves. He is the publisher of the Miami Times, the oldest and largest Black-owned newspaper in the southeastern United States. Well, still to come, creating music in quarantine, the subject of a new rock documentary. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Jillian Hobeika has already established herself as an indie rock singer under the recording name Jillian Dawn. Jill is also a student at the Frost School of Music in the American Music Ensemble program. Daniel Strange is the director of contemporary keyboard studies there, and he's been working with students all semester under the COVID protocols. And one idea that he came up with, actually, to deal with this change in life is he had the students document their life as students, practice, songwriting, performances, everything. They documented all of it, and the end result is a rock documentary that's going to be airing next Monday on the Frost School of Music's website. And you can find the link on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Both Jill and Daniel join us now via Zoom. Jill, Daniel, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us. Great to have you. Usually I'd have you in the studio, but this is the COVID protocols. This is how we do things. You're used to it by now.
We've got it down.
Oh, for sure.
It's the new life. You know, Daniel, I wanted to ask, where did the idea come from to just have the students, you know, basically do what we all do all day, is basically, you know, we're just taking video and selfies of ourselves. But let's take all of that and make a documentary out of it.
Well, that's kind of exactly what it spawned in terms of the idea. I was watching my kids. We got my son an iPad mini this summer to start getting into the tech world. And, you know, he just makes these videos of, hey, everybody, I'm going to do this. And that seems to be sort of the generational thing, like, you know, taking us through your day. And I thought with all of the restrictions in terms of audience members, how many we could have in the room for a show, I thought, wouldn't it be great if I told the students from the beginning of the semester to film the rehearsals, film themselves working at home on the songs, film themselves in their daily routine, and culminate it around the footage of the live recording session we did 2 weeks ago in Clark Recital Hall, and sort of do this back and forth? Because when you're an audience member, you see a concert and you think, man, that was great. But now this gives the viewer and the listener the, you know, story of how did we get to those moments? How did the songs get written? You know, these are all original songs by the students. And so, you know, this is going to sort of not necessarily start from beginning to end, but it's going to bounce around and tell you their stories. That's really what I wanted to do. I wanted to focus on their stories.
And I probably willing to bet that they were on board right away. That sounds like a great idea, right?
I didn't even, it was like, you mean we get to use our phones all the time? Like, yeah, no problem. We're in.
Let's do it. Absolutely. You know, Jill, I mean, I've talked to different students in different fields. You know, the pandemic has scared some people away. They decided, you know, I'll take some time off, not go to school to be safe. But I'm wondering, why was it important for you to continue taking classes?
Well, I spent the whole summer at home, and I love my family, and I loved hanging out with them and having that quality time. But I needed to kind of escape for a little while. And if I had the opportunity to be in person and maybe even perform with some of my friends, I was going to take that opportunity no matter what. I did not perform a lot this summer, and which is how I typically spend my summers. So having an opportunity to do that, I was definitely going to take that 100%. And I trusted UM to like be safe with all COVID protocols.
I think about, you know, first of all, like what's different for you in the way you take classes compared to before?
Well, most classrooms are pretty empty. Every seat is 6 feet apart. We really can't perform in front of an audience in the recital halls that we have, which is very strange for us. And I don't really mind online classes, but that's obviously a new thing that we have to adapt to.
But how do you do that with, I mean, like I can take an online math class. I get that, but this is performance. This is, you got to be in a room with the other people. So you play off their cues and you could see each other and you're, it's about the sound connecting. How do you do it?
For sure. Well, the good thing about AME is that we were able to do it in person this year, which was amazing. And when we were online, when we did have our meetings, we just basically were talking through songs. So I was lucky enough to have that ability to perform in person with people, but the masks were definitely hard to adapt to. As a singer, especially, it's very difficult. It's just another obstacle to kind of get over and to get your voice out. It's already hard to project without a microphone. And when we did have microphones, that helped, but we didn't have them all the time.
Yeah. And you said AME, American Music Ensemble. That's what, right?
Yes. Yes. Okay.
Daniel, tell me a little bit about the challenges. She's talking about these challenges, masks, distance, you know, I mean, that had to be really hard.
I think by now most everybody on campus is so used to it because it's just what we do. We're all very comfortable. I think the biggest challenge was initially going from almost 5 months of being pretty isolated with your families to opening up school and just getting used to being around people. I was joking with them the other day. I can remember like the first week or so, I mean, everybody was following the rules and the, you know, the UM mitigation strategies, which were great, and they were all in place, and it was awesome that they were so on top of this. But just sort of watching everybody kind of tiptoe around people again, you know, it's like, oh, we can do this. We're in the same room. And as each week went on, it was like, okay, so we'll introduce some of the live singing now. And, yeah. But what we did initially was really cool. We had the students, I had my songwriters record their vocals into stems on production software. So they would play that track of them singing, and it was a great opportunity for them to really dive into the arrangement and get the instrumentalist to be like, oh, we could do this here, we could that here. And the whole time we're hearing the vocalist, we don't have to worry about sort of any of that aspect. So that really helped at the beginning.
Still, very strange world. Let's take a listen to a portion of this concert documentary. This is the song Vices from Jill's latest release in 2020.
Possessive, too aggressive, so obsessive when it comes to you. I have no right, your heart ain't mine. Maybe this time I'll make a move. Ooh, I've thought of the thought of you up so tight and spilled over his flood in the night. What if I was the one who took you home? And what if I was the one you couldn't leave?
The story behind this piece.
I wrote this one last year, and last semester, and it was, it doesn't really have a story. I just kind of was playing a bass line on my guitar and was experimenting with a different type of guitar playing, and I just kind of rolled with it, and that's kind of where it came from. It's actually produced by all UM alumni as well.
Yeah. Again, I'm talking with Jill Hobeika. She goes by Jillian Dawn on Spotify, and she's a student at the University of Miami's Frost School of Music. Her professor, Daniel Strange, is with us as well, and we are discussing the end-of-year concert that's next Monday. It's a rock documentary about performing during COVID. Daniel, I'm wondering, you know, what advice are you giving to your students about the future of the industry? You know, touring especially, because again, we don't know how long this is going to last.
You know, I'm trying to tell them that, yes, you're exactly right. Nobody has the end game or the timeline, which is the part that is not comforting. But the comforting side is that live performance is going to return. It is returning in many ways at our school, which is such a great thing moving forward. But I'm also telling them that this has given you an opportunity to adapt to a world in terms of the live stream world, the production aspect, the video content that has only been amplified by the situation. And now, because you have all of those skill sets that you are able to balance as a professional musician, and I think that's one of the great attributes that we are training our students for at Frost, is to be able to adapt during this situation. And as audiences are able to come back and restrictions are lifted, I feel like there's just going to be this cultural explosion that they're just going to be ready for.
And do you think that we, you know, I'm wondering, I think a lot of us wonder, like, will there just be that day when we can just say, all right, I can go back to the concert, I can go back to a show? Or will it be a slow process, do you think? How do you think it's going to be like for performers?
I think performers, you know, obviously everybody will take cues from the medical community and how this plays out. And hopefully we see improvements. You know, we see the news, of course, about the vaccines coming and strategies that do work and treatment options. But aside from the medical aspect, it's more about, like, again, just figuring out where your niche is for a while. Like, I see live halls, because they've added this streaming element, that this could become a series for a lot of venues, where some of my students who are maybe just starting out as beginning emerging artists could get on platforms such as, you know, these stream options and build a fan base that way. So so that when the live element is really back in full force, without any kind of, you know, restriction element, they would already have built this following. And so this is a real opportunity for them, in my opinion.
Jill, as a performer, I mean, look, you've already had the opportunity to, you were building your career and your brand before this happened, but I'm wondering, you know, has this, I know it shifted your life like everybody else, but I'm wondering if maybe it's helped you become more creative, because now you got to find another way to, you know, reach your fans and build the fan base.
Yeah, for sure. Obviously, everyone has to adapt during this time. And as a senior, especially, it's a little scary knowing that the world is so upside down and the live entertainment industry is we don't know when it's coming back, which is very scary. And it's even more unreliable as a job. But I'm hoping, I've just been kind of posting things on my Instagram. I've been really into doing live streams on my Instagram feed. I tried to do like a songwriter's circle this summer with a few of my friends where they came in and we all performed a couple songs together. And I think we just have to find those ways to connect with everyone and just keep producing content. I was kind of uninspired this summer. And now that I'm back at school, I've been writing a lot more and you just got to keep pushing through. And I've learned to produce a little bit on the side, which is something that I normally wouldn't have the time to dive into. So there's obviously a lot of negatives to this COVID situation, but there are a lot of positives and I've learned so much as an artist in the last couple of months.
You know, I want to hear from both of you as we wrap up here is back to this documentary and kind of what did it teach you? And, you know, Daniel, let me start with you. What did it teach you as a teacher? And is it something you'll do again?
I think it taught me that if you can pitch an idea to a student group that's unique, and you have a group of students that I have that were immediately into it, it becomes a sort of way of life for the many weeks that we've been doing this. I will say on a technical side, and now that I'm sort of have dived into this film aspect, you can have so much footage that is probably not going to make it because you don't want the presentation to be 5 hours. But, you know, they just kind of did so much more than I could have ever imagined and got really creative, obviously, but didn't stage things, just really captured themselves. And again, the focus is a jump around to their music and performed at a high level with fantastic multi-camera angles in the room and, you know, top sound. But then there's the element again of meeting the students. You wouldn't have gotten that in just the one night show.
Right.
So now you get to see their snapshot. And yeah, I would definitely do it again. In fact, it came up today, like, are we going to do this again next semester? And I was like, let's just pause so that I can catch my breath and we can all catch our breath and we'll see how this goes.
Daniel, if you don't know anything about students, no, they don't want to pause. They're ready for the next one. Let's go. That's having worked with college students.
I'm not going to get a break.
Yep. I know. That's how it is. Mm-hmm. Jill, I'll finish with you. I mean, for you with this experience, what was it like? And you know, what should the audience take away from this experience when they see it next week?
I think that, well, I just learned to not take anything for granted, specifically performing. And I think that the audience is going to see how much fun we're having with one another and how we are really just taking advantage of the time that we have together, because we have to make the most of what we can. And I just think that when you watch it, you'll just see how much fun and how excited we are to be with one another. And it's just, I'm really lucky to have this to look back on, because obviously this is not the way that I imagined like ending my college career, but it's definitely going to be something that I'm very excited to look back on, and I'll always have that. And just the amount of hard work that we put into this, I think it's going to show through on the screen. So I'm really excited to have everyone see it.
Jill, you and your peers will have stories to tell for decades. Nobody else ever had. So think of it that way. I want to thank my guest, Jill Hobeika. Again, she goes by Jillian Dawn on Spotify. She's a student at University of Miami's Frost School of Music. Her professor, Daniel Strange. We've been talking about their end of year concert. It's next Monday. It's a rock documentary. They're going to be performing, you know, and check it out. You can find out more on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Jill, Daniel, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing. And this sounds like a lot of fun, so it's probably something we'll be seeing a lot more of.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you very much.
All right, and that's our program for this Monday, November 16th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we're going to hear from two investigative reporters from ESPN. Over the past several years, they've been reviewing the case files of Brian Fata, the former UM star who was headed to the NFL before he was shot and killed. They'll explain the resistance they faced from the Miami-Dade Police Department. Plus, the Miami Book Fair kicked off this past weekend and continues. We're going to revisit editorial director Alicia Zuckerman's conversation with author Judy Blume. All of that coming up tomorrow on the program. I'm Luis Hernandez. Stay safe. Be good to each other. We'll talk to you again live tomorrow.